When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Ask Katie Anything. I'm your host, licensed marriage and family therapist, Katie Morton. I'm so glad that you're here. In this week's episode, I'm going to talk about eating disorder recovery and why we can struggle to let go of it and even figure out who we are without it. I'm also going to talk about why we can have romantic feelings for our therapist and whether or not we should tell them about that. Then I'll get into how we can ask our parents to get us help, like if we need to see a therapist or a psychiatrist, psychologist, how do we ask for that? And how to return to regular exercise when we're in eating disorder recovery. I'm also going to talk about how to tell people about our upsets and things we're struggling with without trauma dumping or oversharing. And finally, I'm going to dig into self-deprecating thoughts and how we can get ourselves out of that cycle. Okay, without further ado, let's jump into question number one. This question says, hey, Katie, thanks so much for an amazing channel. Of course, happy to help. It says, I'm currently going through eating disorder recovery and I'm having a hard time parting with it because many of the behaviors, healthy eating and exercise, almost feel part of my identity. I feel like I need to detach or separate myself from that person, but it's so hard. Any tips on navigating identity and eating disorders? Now we have, I want to say, two or three add-ons to this, but let's just dive right in. This is the reason that we are often instructed by our therapist or treatment team to name our eating disorder. By giving our eating disorder another name, like there's a great book, I think it's Jenny Schaefer is the one who wrote it, called Life Without Ed. I'd pick that book up. I'll actually add it to my Amazon shop if it's not already in there. You can go to amazon.com/shop/Katie Morton. You can find that and Eating in the Light of the Moon, which is another beautiful book for eating disorder recovery and honestly for anybody. But that's the reason Life Without Ed, she calls her eating disorder Ed. And what we call that is externalization. And the important piece of that is that it detaches us, like me, Katie, hello, from my eating disorder, this other thing. I think we can do that for any mental illness. I've had patients call their anxiety something else, right? You can name whatever it is you're struggling with, and that allows you to talk about it as if it's not you. Because unfortunately, when we're talking about mental illnesses, it's in our head talking to us. We have this experience. We feel these urges or compulsions to do certain behaviors. And it can feel like that is who we are. That feels like it's just part of our personality. However, we know, or I know intellectually, that it's not, that it's a mental illness, that it's a coping skill. It actually isn't who you are at all. I know it can feel like that. I'm not, you know, trying to minimize or invalidate that, but it is a coping skill. It is a mental illness. It is separate. And naming it really helps with that. For example, you wouldn't, if you had breast cancer or you had lung cancer, you wouldn't think that that's who you are, right? And mental illness should be no different. So that externalization is important. So I would encourage you to name your eating disorder and to call it by that name. And then figure out what makes your eating disorder. Let's give it the personality traits that it's responsible for. And I know this can feel a little maybe strange or woo-woo in some ways, but stick with it because that's going to be really key to teasing out what portions are actually who you are and what parts are your eating disorder. So that's the big first, my first tip. Second tip is to start questioning some of these things that you think are part of your identity, like healthy eating and exercise. Like, what else do you like? If we have a behavior or a pattern of behavior that we are suspicious could be related to our eating disorder, if it's anything to do with food, exercise, likes and don't likes when it comes to food and exercise, let's call that the eating disorder and let's see what else is left. Let's try to tease that out. Let's, every time you think like, but I'm really into exercise, I'm really fit. Sure. Okay. What else do you like? Like, I don't care about that. Like every time your brain tries to pop, well, that's who I am. Imagine me popping in and being like, I don't really care about that. Let's put that aside. Let's give that to Ed. I want to know more about you. What kind of hobbies do you have? Is it exercise? I'm not interested in that. What else do you like to do? Do you like to color? What kind of, are you into fashion? What kind of shows do you like to watch? Tell me about that. And let's explore. And we can explore that through journaling. And I will be honest with you that when we're in recovery from an eating disorder, it takes us a minute to separate ourselves from it in a way that feels real, that's tangible, that we can admit and acknowledge. So give yourself the time needed to be able to say, that's eating disorder, that's me. I don't want that to be a part of my life. That's not who I am. Oh, this little piece actually is. Like a random example would be like, I had a patient who didn't like the taste of, was it olive oil or something that sounded very eating disorder based. But it turned out she actually just really didn't like that flavor. But she was fine with like butter or swip swap. I forget which one it was. It's not really important. But it took us a while to figure that out. And she had to be open to tasting them. And that's how I knew that it really wasn't eating disorder driven, because it wasn't about the calories. It wasn't about the, you know, what it was. It was a quote unquote fat. So bad, right? We need that, right, for our body and brain to work. But she didn't have a problem tasting them. She just was like, I just don't like the flavor of that. Blah, blah, blah. And she'd rather use something different. So I know that that's really strange, but I'm just telling you that like sometimes we have to try things out. We have to, something we think could be eating disorder driven might not be. Maybe you do like exercise. I know that exercise makes me feel better and it makes my hip not hurt. So I do it regularly. But I would need, if I had an eating disorder, I have to figure out like what that looks like. And if it's actually feeding into my eating disorder, maybe I have to stop for a little bit of time and then come back to it. You know, it's going to be a process. So give yourself time. But that externalization piece is going to be really important. And then kind of the self-exploration that can come through journaling and trying new things and teasing that stuff out. That can really, really help as you work toward recovery. Now, we have a lot of comments on this. The first comment says, Katie, I have kind of the same problem. I've always exercised a lot. I was always extremely active, always did multiple sport disciplines. The first thing I say when I have to describe myself is I'm a sporty person or a sports freak. I even call myself a sport addict at times. I don't know who I am without it. I'm even in school to be a physiotherapist. I don't see a way to stop exercising entirely. No one said we have to stop exercising entirely, but what I do say is that we need to challenge where that urge or interest or excitement for exercise comes from. And maybe, just maybe, there's other ways to do that thing without it being so eating disorder driven. For an example, one of my patients was actually a fitness like instructor. And she would teach like these HIIT classes at the local like YMCA. And she also do like personal, she was a trainer. So she was like all over the place, like, you know, what was that one? It's like 24-hour fitness. So she would do all this stuff at all these different locations, different gyms, different, you know, she had all these different people that paid for her to come and train them. And it turns out she doesn't actually really like exercise. And the way that I know this is because I gave her two homework assignments over the time that we saw each other. One was, I don't want you doing any like HIIT, any of the things that you actually train for. I don't want you even lifting any weights this week. I want you to just go for walks. When I tell you, she could not do that. She would find herself running. And then she'd be like, I didn't really get a workout in, so then I had to go home and work out. And I was like, interesting. And then my next homework assignment was, I want you to not do any other workout. I want you just to do yoga 3 times a week. She has never hated something more in her entire life. And yoga's always been a good kind of, not indicator, but kind of like a tester. Like I put it out there and that will tell me if you're able to be slow and methodical and actually be in your body, which most of my eating disorder patients cannot do. The slowness, the deep breath, do you feel your hip, pull your hip in and back, pull your arms out, make sure your fingers are pushed together and straight out. You know, all that random stuff that as someone who's been practicing yoga for, oh God, like 20 years, it is so enjoyable to me and such a good reminder to like feel how it feels in my body. I love it so much. For my eating disorder patients, no. Exercise is not about being in our body. It's about like distracting from it. And so there's a couple ways for us to kind of see what exercise is part of our eating disorder and what exercise is not. And so I challenge you to find different types of, you know, quote unquote exercise, like that homework that I just gave my patient. I would push that on to you. Can we do that? How is that? And I'm not talking hot yoga. I'm not talking crazy power yoga. I'm talking like hatha yoga. Okay. Talking walking, not talking crazy intense hike, walking. And I want you to always be able to talk. I don't want you to be out of breath and see how you feel, because that's potentially the exercise that we're going to be able to do for a while we work on our recovery. Then we can kind of slowly try out different things, but we have to be very cautious, because that pull to get back into exercise and to use it as a way of, you know, earning food or making up for food, for using it as an eating disorder behavior, is going to be there. And it's going to be one that comes back to us pretty easily and pretty quickly. So again, explore, just like I said, with the first component of this question, you want to externalize your eating disorder. I want you to explore who you are, maybe what you like and don't like. And let's try out some different exercises to challenge the fact that, you know, you're super sporty, you're a sports freak, you like to be active, blah, blah, blah. Sure. But let's do it differently and see what comes up for us. Okay. Another person says, I definitely relate. For me, the eating disorder really took a foothold when I lost the ability to play competitive sports. I had a patient like this too, and actually a member of our community, and be part of a team. I filled that void with behaviors and made that in my entire personality. When I went to treatment, it felt like my whole personality shifted while I was there. I later realized after discharging, though, that it was still based around eating disorder types of things. Instead of building my identity around my eating disorder like I had previously, I just morphed it into being centered on recovery and making the right decisions. I'll talk about that. I still had no actual identity and had no idea who I was. Everyone says to lean into things I like, but honestly, I have no idea what I like. And trying things just feels wrong all around. I'm still stuck in the recovery personality era. But I know that if I fully want to kick this eating disorder, I have to completely rid myself of thinking about it in all ways. So I would love to hear an answer to this. Now, I know this doesn't have a specific question in it, and I've kind of given them answers already, but there's a piece in here that I want to talk about. The fact that your identity now revolves around recovery and making the right decisions. I ran into this a lot when I used to work in the treatment centers, where people who had been recovered for a couple of years then became therapists and started working in the treatment centers. Now, I'm not saying that is, you know, 100% of the time that's bad, or that that's something that's not, you shouldn't do. But I will be honest and say that I think too many of us don't know how to let go of it. And so we still focus our whole life on eating disorder treatment and focusing on eating disorders as a whole, their behaviors, how they work. And so I was only one of like three people in that whole treatment center that didn't have an eating disorder. And I want to caution us all against switching from focusing on our own eating disorder to focusing on others. Because I know a lot of you want to be therapists and counselors, and that's wonderful. And the world will be a better place with you doing that and helping other people. However, I just want to make sure that we don't do this swap, where we swap, you know, our eating disorder for us being focused on recovery. And it's all still, again, all about eating disorders, just a different part of it. So that's why I brought that part of that comment or add-on up, is because that is something that we need to be cognizant of. And that's why we have to externalize our eating disorder. We have to do some internal research. And when you said trying new things feels wrong all around, hang in there. There's going to be discomfort. Something that I don't think I talk enough about is the fact that with change, with growth, The way I want to phrase it is that when we want to change and grow, we're not going to be able to do that without discomfort. Does that make sense? Because nobody ever grew without any adversity or challenge. Nobody ever was able to finally kick something if they weren't kind of pushed to do it. We need that internal motivation. We maybe need that external motivation. We need some of that push to get us through. And otherwise, we can sometimes just find ourselves like resting on our laurels. We're kind of recovered enough. We feel maybe decent. I'm not doing stuff all the time. There's no push for us to finally like shed that last layer. And so I feel like that's what we've run into when you're like, it just feels wrong all around. I know this sounds icky, but just, I'm going to be honest. I'm glad it does. It should. You're doing something different. You're exploring you for the sake of you. So hang in there. I know it feels bad, but let's keep trying. Keep trying new things. When your friends invite you to do something, you're like, I have no idea if I don't think I like that kind of food. I don't think I like that kind of activity. I don't know if I like that kind of film. I want you to go anyways. I want you to try it. I want you to push through. And even though it's uncomfortable, I want you to come home and either that evening or the next day, I want you to journal about what came up for you. What did you like or not like? What did you think your friends thought about it? Is that influencing your perspective or your take on it? Let's be curious, not judgmental, as we navigate this new self, okay? Now, there was another add-on. I think it's the final add-on here. And it says, I'm not sure if it's the same for me. I'm very far into recovery, but I'm now afraid of meeting people again who only knew me with my quote-unquote old body. I feel like this isn't me, and that's not what I should look like going into obesity BMI. And one friend of mine told me that she didn't think I have an eating disorder because I had a normal body and that I was neither too fat nor too thin. Well, thank her for her input that wasn't asked for. It says, now I can't see her anymore because I know that she looks so closely at me. And she said a few times how she wants to lose weight because she thinks she's fat and how she thinks it's okay for her mom to call her fat. Ooh. So that she can take measurements against it. I really isolate myself with the thought that I'll get back in touch with old friends as soon as I am my old self again. I'm not actively trying to achieve that body, so I'm not sure if I'll ever talk to old friends again. How can I let it go? There is a grieving piece here when it comes to recovery. And I think what you're going through is kind of that grief, those loss of relationships. Now, I'm not saying we should isolate ourselves. I don't think that's healthy either. But if all of our friends are kind of focused or they exist in our life because of our eating disorder, because we'll be surprised the people that we'll connect with. If we're having a really bad time, having like a really poor body image, we'll probably connect with other people who are doing the same thing. If we're over-exercising, then we're probably going to connect with other like gym rats, people who are spending most of their free time exercising or doing other things because we find like-minded people, right? And there's nothing wrong with finding like-minded people, but when it feeds into a bad type of behavior, a coping skill we want to get rid of, then we're going to have to find new people. And the fact that your friends, first of all, would comment on your body and say they didn't think you had an eating disorder, they're judging, you know, you're not too fat, you're not too thin. And the fact that your friend has that really unhealthy relationship with their mother, all of that sounds very icky to me. And it doesn't mean those friendships can't be rekindled at a later time or done in a healthier manner. But while you're in your own recovery and trying to work on yourself, I don't think it's in your best interest to spend a lot of time with them because that can be incredibly triggering. And especially when you're trying to not lose weight, you know, you're concerned about your looking one some kind of way and feeling like your old body and now you're in a new body. And what if they say something? The fact that they've said stuff in the past would make me nervous too. I'm afraid they'll say something also. And so I might just keep my distance from them a little bit longer while we hopefully go out and meet different people, maybe in our eating disorder treatment groups. I was actually just on a call with the Alliance, the National Alliance for Eating Disorders. You can go to the National Alliance for Eating Disorders website and they have free groups available. I did not know of all their resources. They've expanded recently, they were saying. And they also have a helpline specific to eating disorder support. So you can look them up. You can check them out. That's a great resource for you to get some extra support when you need it because those quote unquote friends don't sound like helpful or healthy friends at this very moment. I would encourage you to try to meet new friends who know you for who you are now, who aren't going to say anything about your body or comment on your weight. Another way to go about it, if you really want to rekindle these friendships, is to have conversations before you see them in person where you tell them that you're in recovery and ask that they not mention how you look or your body. Now, if you don't feel able to do that, you can practice in therapy, you can write some things down, we can journal about it until we feel comfortable, but that's really the only way that I can see you engaging with them now without it potentially setting you back or being upsetting or triggering in some kind of way, okay? Hang in there, it does get better. And we can slowly but surely will distance ourselves from our eating disorder, forget who that old version of us was, be able to navigate the urges or the thoughts and get to know what we like and don't like that has nothing to do with our eating disorder. But we have to be patient, right? Our eating disorder didn't happen overnight. It didn't get this developed or this palpable until, you know, years and years of probably engaging with it. So give yourself time to kind of untangle that from who you are and your life, okay? Okay, let's move on to question number two. This question says, Katie, should I tell my therapist about the romantic feelings and thoughts that I have for her? If so, how should I broach this topic? And is she likely to terminate me? Thank you for all that you do, Katie. Of course, this is a great question. Now, I have a video about this. I want you to get on YouTube and I want you to search for, I think it's erotic transference or romantic transference, Katie Morton. You can look it up. I think it's erotic transference is what I called it. So that's what this is called. It's incredibly common. Now, hear me out. I know it sounds weird. You're like, transference? Isn't that when we transfer an old relationship onto our therapist? Yes, it is. But when it comes to these romantic feelings, there's a couple of pieces here that are important. First of all, it's incredibly common. I know it's embarrassing. We have a tough time with it. But the reason that it happens is when we were growing up, chances are either we had some sexual abuse or some what I would call like sexual behavior that's not appropriate, either from another child or something like that. But usually it's from like a parent, caregiver, or close family member. And the way that they talk about this is that they tell us that they love us. And this is them expressing their love for us, okay? And just hang with me. And because of this like early experience, we correlate any kind of affection, attention, attunement when a parent or someone in our life like gets how we're feeling, checks in, recognizes it, says something to us, and we feel seen and heard. When we have that kind of experience, we automatically jump to, oh, it's romantic. Because the only thing we've known, that blueprint that we were, you know, laying when we're really growing up and trying to discover the world, was laid by these adults who engaged with us in a very inappropriate and abusive way. And so we don't really know how to tease out attention, connection, attunement without attaching romantic feelings, thinking that it's like should be sexualized or it should be love. And those are the only ways we see those two go together. And so when we have a therapist who connects with us, who is consistent, who shows up for us and supports us, is attuned with our feelings and our experiences, we assume it must be romantic. So that's one potential option and very, very common. Another is that we never got any attention, affection. Could have been complete neglect. So abuse in a different way. There wasn't sexual abuse. Maybe there was complete and utter neglect from the, you know, from our family and our parents. And then we were in an inappropriate relationship at some point in our life, probably by someone who was older than us or had more knowledge of sex than we did, which gives them more power over us. And therefore, we always assume that any attention, any connection, again, has to be sexualized, has to be romantic. And so that's why this often happens. That might not resonate with you. Everybody's situation is different, but that just hopefully gets the ball rolling to help you better understand why you could be feeling this way. Also to normalize it because it's incredibly common. And what I would tell your therapist is, yes, I would share it with them. And the way that I would broach the topic, I'd even bring up like, say, I asked this question of a therapist online and I learned that what I'm experiencing, you know, is like erotic transference or romantic transference. If you don't want to say erotic, I get it. I have romantic thoughts and feelings about you, but I know that it's something to do with therapy and I don't quite understand. Can we talk this through? I want to get a better handle on it. Broaching the topic that way versus saying I have a crush on you or I think you're so pretty or I think you're so handsome or whatever it is going to allow for them to acknowledge if they already don't know, which they should. We're trained in this, but it allow them to acknowledge what you're going through, the experiences you're having, the thoughts and feelings that are coming up and help you tease it out, figure out, you know, where this is coming from, why this is happening. Is it one of those things that I talked about? That means we have some PTSD in our past and it's worth processing through. Or at the very least, we have some attachment issues and things that need to be dealt with. We might need to do some inner child work. It kind of gives them an idea or a better idea of what to work on and how to help you in a better way, be more effective in your treatment. So they won't terminate you. I know that therapists can be weird, and if they don't understand, if we just said like, hey, I have a crush on you and I want to date you, that could be different than the way that we're going to approach the subject, which is by telling them that, hey, you know, I think what I'm experiencing, I've been having like romantic feelings and it feels really weird, and I think it's because of this erotic transference. Can we dig into that and where that comes from? If I feel really uncomfortable with it. That's a great way to approach that topic. And I also have the whole video about it. If, you know, and I think even the thumbnail says like, help, I have a crush on my therapist or something. But check that out and let me know if you have any follow-ups, okay? Okay. But again, it's really common, okay? Don't think anything's wrong with you. Very, very normal and natural. Moving on to question number three. The question says, hi, Katie. Just to set the scene for you, I am a 14-year-old girl and I live with my parents and my sister who is 12. 2 years ago, I started teaching myself dance and gymnastics. And last Easter, when I was about 13 and a half, I dislocated my knee practicing late in the evening. This was at home after my mom had worked 12 hours. The after effects of that completely changed my life. I was told I couldn't dance for 8 weeks. School was completely different due to the measures that my mom put in place for me. For example, I had to go to my school's pastoral office instead of my PE lesson, and I had to leave all of my lessons early to avoid the crowds so you didn't get hurt again, I understand. Things got so overwhelming that I convinced myself that I was having panic attacks and that I had an anxiety disorder. Honestly, I just wanted to put a label on to justify my feelings. You probably just felt very out of control. And like the one thing you probably were doing to control things or to help you feel some semblance of control was taken from you, the dance. But let's get into this. There's more to read here. Also, keep in mind that I couldn't do sport, so I didn't know how to deal with those emotions. There we go. So I suppressed them and then would have crying attacks. Not sure if that's what they'd be called, but hopefully you understand. I totally understand. My best friend suggested that I tell my parents and go to therapy, but the idea of telling my parents makes me feel sick as they don't really support mental health stuff. 13 weeks after the injury, I was cleared to dance again. I finally figured out I don't actually have an anxiety disorder, as I do things very confidently sometimes, but other times I'm a nervous wreck. I think that I have anxiety attacks, and for about a month I've been connecting events to possible triggers, which I won't go into now. Please could you give me some advice on how to let my parents know about all of this without it being overwhelming or receiving negative responses, as I'm only 14, so I can't really leave. Also, when is it bad enough to ask for something like therapy? Even though I'm doing okay now, there are some things in my past that I've kept secret and they still bother me now, even though some were like 8 years ago. Thank you for all that you do. I hope you're having a beautiful day. Of course, I hope you're having a beautiful day. Okay. I have a lot of thoughts. I'll make them quick and then I'll get into those tips. I think we're using exercise and dance as a way to suppress our emotions, or what we would call sublimation. Sublimation is a defense mechanism. It's a coping skill. It's something that we do when we turn all of our anxieties, frustrations, worries, trauma responses, whatever it might be, and we turn it into something that is societally acceptable. For instance, if I'm feeling really terrible, super depressed, I might put all of my energy and all of my focus into my work, so much so that I don't leave any space for feeling bad and depressed, right? It's like I just like push through and hide myself away in it. And I think you're doing that with exercise and dance. Now, I just had to say that, but when it comes to getting therapy, yes, you're deserving of care. The sooner we reach out for help and the sooner we see someone, it's always better. The longer something goes on, the more we have to untangle it from. And the fact that you have things from 8 years ago that are still bothering you, those are important. We need to talk about that as soon as possible. So the ways that we can bring it up with our parents, even if they don't support mental health stuff, first, I want you to start journaling a little bit about what you want them to know. And I want you to do this maybe for a week, okay? And journal, just give yourself like 10, 15 minutes a day. I don't want you journaling forever. I don't want you to feel like you have to keep, unless you want to, you can keep going, but just feel like you, I want you to start jotting some things down, even if it's just a couple minutes of writing. What is it that you want them to know? What's going on with you? And then I want you to, after doing that for about a week, I want you to break it into 3 to 5 bullet points, okay? And the first bullet point needs to be, what's bothering you? And which way can we tell it to our parents where they'll listen? Like an example would be like, hey mom, you know how I like hurt my knee and then I couldn't do dance and I had to, all that stuff was going on at school. You can say that really left me feeling super, super overwhelmed and anxious, and it just hasn't gone away. Okay. That's a very casual way of bringing up our symptoms without getting into too much detail or using the term like panic attack, anxiety attack, stuff like that, especially because we don't know how she'll respond. Then, so that's one bullet point. The next would be what we need from her. So I was hoping that I could get into therapy to try to move past this because it's still bothering me and I still feel upset about it. And then finally, what we need from them. So this is only 3 bullet points, really. So what we'd need from them. So mom, I don't know how to go about it, but I'd really, really like it if we could look into a therapist in the area or maybe one at school. Okay. We make the ask and then we have to wait. Now, you know the language that will resonate, or maybe your parents will be the like most, I don't know, it's most easily digestible for them. They can actually hear you. However you want to put that language together, you put that together and then do it during a time when you're not feeling overwhelmed and they're not feeling overwhelmed. So not after your mom's worked a 12-hour shift, maybe when she's on the second day of her days off, right? If she gets two in a row, I don't know if she's a nurse or what, you know, those 12-hour shifts, usually maybe she's a shift worker in some way. But make sure that you do it on a day off when there's no pressure. Things aren't going crazy. Maybe you're setting the table for dinner and she's like finishing things up. That's a time to have that conversation when things feel pretty mellow. And I want you to feel good too, because we have to be able to sit with the fact that it might take her a minute to reply and her response may not be what we're hoping for. Hopefully it is, but I want you to be able to weather it if it's not. If she's like, I think you're overreacting or whatever, you know, I might encourage you to play that out ahead of time too, so that if she does say, oh, you're fine, you're making this into a big deal, I want you to be able to say to her, I mean, it's possible, Mom, but it's really bugging me. I'm afraid my grades are going to slip. I don't know what would affect her, because if my grades are going to slip, I'm just having a hard time. I'd really like to talk to somebody. Could we look into that? You know, we ask again. So I want you to just have some kind of ideas of things that you could do. I also want you to know that if there is like a roadblock and your parents keep saying no, 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 you can ask at school and they can set that up, because you're 14. In the States, at least you have to be, I think it's over 12 or 13 to seek out your own. So you can technically do it yourself. And I know that depends on the state too, but you're definitely over any of the ages I've heard. So you could ask for some support that way and we could get you help there too. Okay? Okay. Keep me posted. Moving on to question number four. This question says, hey, Katie, how do I get back to normal after eating disorder regarding physical activity? What does a healthy, active lifestyle look like without overdoing it? I'm going to give you some clear points to keep in mind. Now, healthy exercise when we're in eating disorder recovery looks like not exercising when we're sick, not exercising when we're injured, not exercising overdoing something else that is more important. For example, if our friends invited us out for dinner and we haven't seen our friends in a long time, we say no because that's when we're going to go on our run. Okay. And then also, healthy exercise does not keep extending itself, meaning I used to run X number of miles, now I have to run Y number of miles. And if I don't get to that point, I feel bad about myself and I have to keep going until I hit that marker or whatever it is. Okay. And I guess I'd throw in the fifth and final is that exercising doesn't equal worth, meaning if I don't exercise, I don't have to feel bad about myself. If I don't have time today or tomorrow, that doesn't make me a bad person or mean that I'm fat, stupid, ugly, lazy, whatever. It's not attached to worth. And if you keep those things in mind, I believe that we will be able to have a healthy relationship with exercise. Exercise should be something that's done to help our body feel good, to help us heal. Like for me, it helps so that my hip and my low back don't hurt as much. And I call it my chicken wing accident, but it's like on my back, kind of on my shoulder blade. It will ache if I don't do certain stretches, exercises and things. And they kind of look funny, but I do them and they feel better and I'm strengthening and it doesn't hurt me anymore. And that's why I exercise. Exercise should be something you do to help and care for yourself. It should be like medicine. It shouldn't be like punishment. Okay. Now, when it comes to eating disorder recovery, I don't know how far you are into it, but please let your therapist, dietitian, and doctor know. I want to make sure that you're cleared for exercise, that it's okay. And I want you to start off with something simple like walking for 20 minutes. And the reason I say that is because it's important for us to start small and to see what comes up for us as we restart the relationship that we have with exercise. Because often when we have an eating disorder, it's always punishment. It's something we have to do every day or a certain number of times each week or for a certain number of hours, a certain number of miles, blah, 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 blah. We have all these like regulations and limits. And I'd encourage you instead to start with something small. Notice how it feels. Pay attention to the urges, maybe instead of to walk, to run or to do it longer. Like, oh, it's been 20 minutes. I'll just do 21 minutes, right? Like pushing those limits. That's all really key. Because that kind of tells us if we're ready to engage with exercise in a real way or not. I mean, I've had patients, especially in the eating disorder treatment center, we take them on like, as they moved up the levels and worked on their recovery, take them on these like little hikes and walks around, and they weren't strenuous by any means, but they also weren't super, super easy. Some girls would insist on leading the pack. One would try to do like high knees. Someone would try to run a little bit. Someone would try to do like some squats and stuff while they're hiking. Like if you're trying to sneak in some extra activity, that's all helpful to notice. It means that we don't have a healthy relationship with exercise, and maybe we aren't at a place where we can engage with it yet. Maybe instead we should be journaling about what comes up for us, the mere thought or discussion of exercise, or maybe even the fact that you might be angry while you hear me talk about it. That's normal. It's part of the process. So let's be curious, not judgmental, as we learn about ourselves, our relationship with exercise, and slowly start that relationship anew. Okay? Let's move on to question number five. This question says, hi, Katie. I have a question about sharing our internal upsets with relatives. I catch myself lying about how I'm doing for fear of oversharing. I don't want to freak the other person out or burden them with my issues or leave them feeling guilty for not knowing what to do. From my experience, I can either lie, overshare, or stay silent. I don't know how to be honest without oversharing. Any insight would be appreciated. Thank you for continuing to be here. Of course. Now we have an add-on to this, but let's dive into this first. Now, I'm curious why you feel like you can only either lie, overshare, or stay silent. I might encourage you, before we do anything and talk to anyone, I want you to define what oversharing is. I want you to think about, or maybe like you're telling it to me, how would you define overshare? Because is it actually over? Are we sharing more than someone can manage? Are we dumping everything and crying and falling apart? Are we taking up all the air in the room and we don't leave any room for anybody else to speak? Is that what's happening? Or are we just sharing that we're having a tough time and we've been told our whole lives that we're too much and that we can't take up space and that we should just shut up and sit down? I want to know more about this overshare, because the truth about being honest and sharing about where we're at and how we're doing is just that, where we're at and how we're doing. I should be able to tell you, you know, I'm having a hard time. It's been a rough year. I mean, you guys know personally, I've shared probably more than I would have liked to looking back. I have a little, you know, vulnerability hangover. But my goal with sharing any of my personal stuff is so that you know you're not alone in your struggles either. Nobody's perfect. Everybody has hard times. And in that sharing, it's just sharing what I'm going through. And then if we were having a conversation, I would leave space to hear. I'd be like, and how are you, right? Follow up with you. I want to hear about you. It's not necessarily always 50-50, but relationships and conversations kind of ebb and flow. There's give and take. There's always sharing on both sides. As long as you're doing that, I don't see how this is oversharing. Oversharing looks like someone not really asking for all of the content and we tell them everything and we monopolize the conversation. We share things that relationship we really don't usually share with them. It could be like really intimate or personal things and our relationship is not at that depth or level. But I think sharing how you're doing, like, oh, I'm doing okay. You know, I've been feeling kind of depressed lately, but I'm trying to pull myself out of it. You know, it's been hard because of, I don't know, I lost my grandma and papa. I'm just making this about me now. And so sometimes I have a hard time. I don't really love where I live. So I'm trying to figure out that. That's just regular sharing. That's not oversharing. Oversharing is when we like dump on people, when we tell them all these personal things without having that depth of a relationship and without the invitation, and we don't ask them for anything, any follow-ups. Like, so how are you? So I don't really think that you're oversharing, but I want you to start defining those terms. And I want you to kind of be curious if that's just because someone's told you that, if that's how your family dynamic is. And it's possible that if that's the case and it doesn't feel safe to share with family, then we need to work on our friendships and build those up so that we do have a place to talk about what's really going on. And we don't have to pretend that we're okay or either lie, overshare, or stay silent, because none of those are healthy. Okay. There was a follow-up. It says, follow-up question to this, Katie. I had an experience as a teenager where police attended my home for a welfare check without me aware that this was going to happen. As a result, my parents asked me to be honest with them about my mental health. I've done so well at this, but now in my mid-20s, I've started working through my sexual assault and domestic violence past, and I went through with my ex. This topic has, I don't know if it's sexual assault or sexual abuse. It's just SA. This topic has thrown me into some really dark and suicidal thoughts, and I've been able to discuss these with my therapist and closest friends. During my last appointment, I spoke to my family, but I'm still struggling to speak up now that things are getting darker again. I've been told that I don't need to open up to everyone about everything, correct? I'm not even sure what my question is fully, but how do I manage the fear of telling people and them overreacting and worrying versus danger of staying silent. Find the people that are safe and let them know, I guess, since it sounds like your family called and they did a wellness check on you because they were worried, and that can be really traumatizing and scary, but unfortunately people don't always understand. I would talk to your therapist and potentially just your closest friends. And since your family seems to maybe not understand, or they get too worried because they love you, we're going to need to have some maybe difficult conversations, or we might just not want to tell them about maybe the suicidal thoughts. I want you to have places and spaces where you can share about that. I might keep that in therapy and possibly with your closest friends who actually get it and can listen and support you. But we could also have these uncomfortable conversations, and I say uncomfortable because that's, I'm assuming that'll feel that way, to share with them about your suicidality. A lot of people think that if we have thoughts, that means we're going to do it, because they aren't trained like a mental health professional. And so they worry and they want you to be safe. And so it might be helpful for us to talk to our parents and say, I have these thoughts. I have no plans, no means. It's just something that I deal with when I'm having a hard time. And I want you to understand that you don't have to call in a welfare check, but you can check up on me. You can call me and I promise to pick up. We have to have some kind of agreement so that they feel safe and they know that you're okay, right? Because that's really the concern here, is they love you and they want you safe, but they don't really know how to ask you those questions. Also, I think it's important to let them know you can't make it worse by just asking me about it. Like, you're not going to cause suicidal thoughts by saying, hey, have you been suicidal lately? I either have them or I don't. You don't create them into people. And unfortunately, some people still think that. And so talk with your therapist, maybe come up with some of the things that you wish your parents or friends knew. And let's see if we can give them an opportunity to meet us where we're at. It's not our goal, or our responsibility rather, to educate them on this, but it can give them an opportunity to understand us and then be there for us. And so let's hope that they will listen and be educated by us sharing. We just have to figure out how to share. And that's what you'll practice in therapy and even journal about. But having some kind of conversation around it, I think, can really, really help. And it can ensure that we don't have these welfare checks that can be super scary. They won't try to hospitalize us, which can also be scary. We want to make sure that you have people to talk to so that you don't have to stay silent and feel like you're more in danger. Okay? Moving on to our final question, question number 6. This question says, hey, Katie, I'm not sure why, but I constantly am having self-deprecating thoughts and sometimes can't even tell my own feelings in a moment. I have a mother who is constantly talking down to me, always getting mad at me about little things, and always has to yell at me about something. I mentioned that I think I might be dealing with emotional abuse to my therapist, and she agreed. I was going to say it is that too. And she thinks that I am as well. She told me that if I wanted to try and better the relationship I have with my mom, that she'd help me, but it seems that the time has gone by as time has gone by, the way my mom talks to me and treats me has gotten worse, and it feels like it'll never get better. I'm not sure what to do, and it feels like I'm stuck. My therapist wanted me to use the wheel of emotions, but even when I look at this thing with all the words and the different emotions, none of them seem to click in my brain or seem to fit with whatever I'm feeling, and it feels like something's wrong with me. What does this mean? Are there other ways I can figure out how I might feel? Will I ever just be able to figure it out and just always feel like there's something wrong with how my brain works? Okay. A couple of things. Yes, that's emotional abuse. And I would, like, a hypothesis I would have, and I would, if I was a betting person, I put all my money down on the fact that these self-deprecating thoughts come from the fact that your mom has emotionally abused you your entire life. So you don't actually know how to speak nicely to yourself because your mom has never done that for you. She's never shown you how to offer yourself some compassion, some care, some love, some support. She doesn't know how to do that. Instead, she's abusive. And I'd assume she does the same to herself, but that doesn't condone it. That doesn't make it okay. What she's doing is incredibly wrong and incredibly abusive. And I would continue to talk to your therapist about this. Since it feels like it's getting worse and worse, I don't know if you live with your mom. I don't know your situation that way, but I would probably distance myself from her as much as possible. If you don't live at home, I wouldn't contact her or talk to her very often, maybe once a week for 20 minutes, or if that's already what you're doing, maybe it's every other week for 20 minutes. Let's limit our contact. If we live at home, let's have other activities that we're doing. If we're in school, let's do some after school activities. Let's volunteer to help out with the play or the sporting event. We'll be the manager for X, Y, or Z. Let's do some shit so that we don't have to go home. okay? Or maybe we do study hall after school. That's what we want to do, our homework there. Easier to focus at school. Let's do that stuff, okay? Just to limit that interaction, because it's not helping you and it's feeding your self-deprecating thoughts. And then the truth about like getting out of that cycle is to start paying attention to what you're saying to yourself. And we got to bridge statement it. Remember, bridge statements aren't positive, but they're not as negative. So we need to say something like, you know, let's say the negative thought is, I'm so stupid and lazy. Then the bridge statement would be, you know, I hear Katie when she says that I'm not as stupid and lazy as I think I am, but I don't believe her, but I'm open to the fact that I can work on this and that it might get better. That's a start. Let's work from there. Doesn't seem like a huge leap because it's not, but it will feel better. And we just start slowly working and building a bridge from the self-deprecation space that we're in into a more positive and happy space. Now, the question about why you can't identify your feelings, because you're disconnected because you've been abused for a long, long time, possibly your whole life. And so it's safer to disconnect from our emotions. So you've never been able to identify them because you don't even know. So my homework for you is to stop trying to identify them in yourself. And let's watch one of our favorite shows. I don't know. I mean, I am a fan of Sex and the City. I'm a fan of Gilmore Girls. I'm a fan of Friends. If there's a show that you like, let's put it on. I don't even care what it is. Any kind of TV show or film. And as people go through experiences, maybe like look for three in the whole show or in the whole movie. And I want you to identify what feelings that character is experiencing. Like, let's say, you know, it's Gilmore Girls and Lorelai is having an issue in one of her relationships, and they really hurt her feelings. And I want you to pause it and I want you to write down, Lorelai feels clearly is showing sadness, upset, or anger with her parents. They're so pushy or controlling or whatever. I want you to write down a little bit about like what you think they're experiencing. And then if you can, so we're going to start there. And I want you to do that a few times, like, you know, a couple times this week. I want you to watch something and tell me what your characters are experiencing, like name that emotion. You can use that feelings wheel for that. And then if you can, the next step would be, what does that feeling look like? Why do we think it's sadness? Why do we think it's frustration? Why do you think it's excitement? Write it down. And we're just getting to know emotions, because how can you identify them in yourself when you've never been able to, it's never felt safe to feel them. So we've just disconnected. So then how are you supposed to do all that? You can't. We have to start at one step at a time. So let's start there and then report back. Okay? Okay. Thank you all so much for watching and listening. Thank you for sharing this podcast. Thank you for leaving all your questions. Thank you. Have a wonderful rest of your week. Take care of yourselves. Do your homework. And I'll see you next time.